Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up later in the show, we cover the National Black Growers Council Annual Field Day. That's coming up in segment four today, but we start with Taylor Chalstrom.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with Franz Niederholzer, UCCE Farm Advisor for Colusa, Sutter, and Yuba Counties about activator spray adjuvant selection in trees and vines and matching the proper material to the job. Welcome, Franz.
Hi, Taylor. Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, great to have you here again. Franz, my first question for you here, activator adjuvants can have a place in tree and vine crop sprays, but matching the material to the job can be a little tricky. When might growers consider using an adjuvant in their tank mix? And, you know, how do they determine really which one to use?
Well, the easy answer is if it's on the label. So there are some labels, some products that specify a certain adjuvant material activator. It might be a pH adjustment, might be a penetrator. There's some in some labels that say don't use this particular activator or adjuvant. So that's the, you know, the number one thing is if it's on the label or if it's specifically not, you know, label specifies not to use it, that's critical. As far as the decisions, if it's not on the label, but the label says, you know, maybe use with an adjuvant to improve efficacy, things of that nature, working with an experienced PCA who can make the recommendation, that's a really good step. That a PCA with that kind of experience has seen this product, that product combination that's being recommended across a range of applications, a lot more experience than you'd be able to develop on your own place. So that's really critical. There are a lot of materials out there, different adjuvants, different pesticide formulations, products. Having somebody who does that every day, as PCAs do, it's really good to have in your court to help you make the right decision.
I'm curious, in the instance where a grower maybe is thinking about using an adjuvant that is not listed on the label, but it's not necessarily listed to not used, yeah. You know, what do they do there?
Well, it depends upon the job. If you're putting on a cover spray, you want something that's going to not penetrate into the tissue so much, but be more of a spreader. If you have something that is a translaminar that gets into the plant, works that way, you've got a penetrating type material. Ahead of rainfall, a rain fast or a sticker might reduce the amount of would slow, not eliminate, but slow the wash-off effect. Or sometimes a humectant has a, well, if you're going to be applying in a really dry atmosphere, high evaporation conditions, a humectant, which slows the rate of evaporation is a good product to use. So really, what's the material you're using? What's the mode of action for the pesticide? The activator, the adjuvant, it really is assists the pesticide. It's not going to make or break the job. Again, less on the label, separate from what the active is in the tank.
And yeah, you were mentioning just a little bit ago some of those main classifications for some of the adjuvants like penetrators and whatnot. You know, growers do really have a number of choices when considering these adjuvants for their tank mixes. What are some of those main classifications of the available adjuvants at the moment, and what are some of their characteristics?
Well, the wetter spreaders reduce the surface tension, and they literally make the droplets run across the surface. They don't make the droplets jump from leaf to leaf, but if you get some material on a leaf, you're going to get much more much more spread from, you know, an organosilicone or there are some non-ionic surfactants that have, well, most of them have some spreading capacity, but the super spreaders, the organosilicones are the best. They're called super spreaders because they do reduce the surface tension to a degree that if you're not careful, you can actually run the product right off the leaf or your target surface, which you don't want to do. So matching your rate, again, back to working with a good PCA, matching your rate to the job and the size of the tree, the amount of surface area that you're trying to cover, that's really important with the spreaders. The penetrators, generally those are oil-based, either petroleum oil, like a crop oil concentrate, or a vegetable oil material, like some of the methylated seed oils. Those are intended to get materials through the waxy surface of the leaf, and that's beneficial in some, you know, you're trying to get the pesticide into the plant, whether it's a say a miticide like abamectin or an herbicide, get past the protective leaf surface. Those materials, not necessarily great spreaders on their own, but they're intended to penetrate. And that's one of the reasons why the oils are such good penetrators. That's one of the reasons why, say, zinc nutrient or sulfur labels say don't apply with an oil, because you want the zinc or the sulfur on the leaf surface. It's toxic inside the leaf, and the oil will drive that material across the leaf surface. And so that's penetrators. You know, humectants, sometimes they're oils, other times certain hydrophilic fertilizers are humectants. And stickers are oftentimes resin type materials or materials that literally are resin based plant. There's some historically some plant based materials, pine byproducts that literally mix in with the fertilizer, probably with the pesticide, and keep it from dissolving in rainwater. Which, you know, if part of your problem is, part of your goal is to, if a rain's coming, you got a fungicide on, you want to redistribute that fungicide, as putting a sticker on it may not be the tool that you want, or using a sticker when you really want to penetrate the material, that would be counterproductive. So those are some of the major ones. I didn't mention, acidifiers also usually going to be an acid type material. Those are important if the job calls for it.
We're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlanté is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlanté wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplanté.com.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Hi, we're back talking with Franz Niederhalter, UCCE Farm Advisor for Colusa, Sutter, and Yuba Counties about activator spray adjuvant selection in trees and vines and matching the proper material to the job. Franz, my next question for you here, what are the cautions growers should be aware of, you know, if the wrong adjuvant is chosen, and can it damage the crop or the tree?
That's a great question. You have to be very careful. Certain combinations And it's very difficult. Certain combinations can lead to phyto issues on the leaves, and in a worst case scenario, on a fresh fruit where you're damaging the marketable product. It's very hard to know which combinations do the damage. And because the value of tank mixing, the economic value of tank mixing is so great, nobody wants to make two applications when they can make one. You end up mixing different active ingredients, different formulations, and perhaps throwing an adjuvant in there too. It's again that back to that having working with somebody who's got the experience to steer you to or away from a certain combination is really important. But you can really run into issues with phyto if you're not careful.
If and when it gets to the point where it's affecting marketable fruit, are growers often confusing the damage on marketable fruit with like other things, like other disease, or is it pretty distinguishable from other damage that could happen to marketable fruit?
That's a good question. It can be, and that's why looking at a block that's been sprayed versus a block that hasn't been sprayed, presence or absence of damage can help you get down, figure out whether it's a phyto issue or not. Where if it's phytotoxic, oftentimes you'll see the spray material may run and pool at the bottom of a fruit or bottom of a leaf. That is indicative of a burn. Whether the burn is due to the product that's applied or the combination of the surfactant and the product is hard to tell. But comparing what you've got in your orchard to other sites and where the damage is on the tissue is part of unfortunately figuring out just what went wrong if there is something there that's either worrisome or worst case potentially costly.
Franz, how can a grower really get the best efficacy out of an adjuvant? Are there practices that they can follow to do that?
Well, first of all, adjuvants are always the adjuvants that go on as suggested use. They're icing on the cake. They're not specifically stated on the label required for the application. They provide maybe better coverage on the leaf surface, stretching a pesticide, the gallons of spray in the tank across the surface area. But the critical point is that the sprayer has to be calibrated for good coverage, and the coverage has to be delivered, and then the activator can sort of be the icing on the cake or the spreader or the penetrator, get the job done, the job a little bit. But most times the adjuvant, again, if not listed on the label, is the final, the final step that gives you the best possible outcome. But everything else has to be done properly up to that point. The timing has to be right. Application, as I said, to get the job done right. And then the adjuvant helps fill in any possible gaps that got missed. But dial in everything else, and then the adjuvant helps out at the end. But you can't fix bad timing or a bad spray job with an adjuvant. That's not, shouldn't be an expectation of a grower.
Are there any times at all where a grower just doesn't have to use an adjuvant when they're applying their pesticides, or is it pretty much just a standard practice?
Well, you can get very good results with a well-calibrated sprayer without the use of adjuvants. Most formulated pesticides come with adjuvants in them, different, sometimes a compatibility adjuvant, sometimes they're, affect the surface area, surface tension, things of that nature. Adjuvants don't make or break a spray job. They're that little bit of icing in the cake. So you can get a very good job if you spray carefully. You should be able to get the job done. If you're a little bit of short on liquid, and you're using 100 gallons an acre, and maybe 120, 130 would be perfect. You might be able to, a spreader adjuvant may spread the job, but you have to get the spray on those leaves in order for it to spread on the leaf. It's not going to, as I said before, jump from branch to branch or leaf to leaf. So And also, so adjuvants are the icing on the cake. And there are times when there are, for instance, at bloom time, when bees are present, particularly when bees are present in the orchard, mm-hmm. adjuvants are designed to spread the material, to get material into plant tissue. They can also get the material into the tissue of bees. So the general rule that we follow and the university recommends is to avoid adjuvants in the spray tank when bees are present in the orchard, particularly we're talking about fungicides at bloom. So those times are particularly important to avoid the adjuvant.
Okay, sounds good. Good sentiment there. Franz, my last question for you here. Do you have any other tips for tank mixing adjuvants in trees and vines? Maybe anything that we haven't covered yet?
Read the label, work with the experienced PCA, those are critical. If you're doing this, making this decision yourself, I would spot check the combination of materials with an adjuvant that you're looking for. You can do a jar test, mixing that particular product with a little bit of the adjuvant to see if there's any compatibility issues. There's so many wild cards to be considered. Being cautious with adjuvant selection, where it's just a suggested product, not recommended on the label, is going to pay off, or at least help you avoid that difficult situation where icing on the cake turns out to be left on the counter overnight. You've got problems. So being very being careful with those suggested materials is the best way to go.
Well, thank you for all of your suggestions and advice on some of this spray adjuvant selection, and also giving a little clarification on some of the main classifications and those characteristics. We really appreciate you coming on and talking about it today.
Thanks very much, Taylor. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Of course, as always. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
Our news brief is up next. We will be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Here's your news for today. In an open letter penned earlier this month, the National Milk Producers Federation is urging farmers and ranchers to get the COVID-19 vaccination. NMPF's Teresa Sweeney says vaccination rates in rural America are lagging behind their urban and suburban counterparts, which is problematic for a variety of reasons, she says.
Certainly lower vaccination rates are leading to an increased number of COVID-19 infections, including severe cases where patients need to be hospitalized. And rural areas are already medically underserved, so the availability of hospital beds and of equipment is already limited.
Sweeney says the Federation has done a series of vaccine promotions, including an op-ed by Randy Mooney, published in the Des Moines Register and USA Today, just to name a few.
We have a COVID-19 toolbox that's going out with, and that is about the Delta variant and what dairy employers need to know about it.
She noted the Federation has been promoting vaccinations since the spring. A group of House Democrats sent a letter to leadership asking for $75 million in funding for the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service to prevent and prepare for a possible African swine fever outbreak in the U.S. A total of 7 House Democrats are concerned about an ASF outbreak in America's swine herds. They're asking House leadership to include the requested funds in the next continuing resolution or supplemental appropriations package that moves through Congress. A USDA program was recently expanded to help drought-impacted livestock producers recover some of their costs associated with transporting feed due to poor grazing conditions. Rod Bain reports.
It is one of the programs available from the Agriculture Department to help livestock producers in the West and Great Plains mitigate the impacts of severe drought conditions.
The Emergency Livestock Assistance Program, called ELAP.
And Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack recently explained during a White House press briefing that through ELAP,
historically, we've always provided resources to farmers to be able to pay for the cost of hauling water to their facilities. If they had a situation with a drought and they needed to access additional water, there's a cost associated with that, and we helped to defer some of that expense.
Now, new adjustments at ELAP will also cover costs for the transport of feed for drought-impacted livestock that rely on grazing.
We know that these farmers, particularly in the western U.S., are going to be confronted with having to truck or rail feed from far distances, and that's going to be an incredibly increased cost to them. So we're going to use this emergency program to provide up to 60% of the additional costs that they're incurring above and beyond what they would normally incur for transportation expense. And for limited resource farmers, it could be as much as 90% of assistance and help.
ELAP is under the Farm Service Agency suite of programs. FSA Administrator Zach Ducheneau explains some of the logistics involved with ELAP covering feed transportation costs of eligible producers.
This will trigger when the drought intensity is D2 for 8 consecutive weeks, or that drought intensity is D3 on the drought monitor.
Or if USDA determines a shortage of local or regional feed availability. Additional details on how feed transportation cost assistance is determined include:
a formula which will be established by the FSA and the USDA will be used to determine those reimbursement costs. We won't include the first 25 miles. We won't include distances over 1,000 miles because we have to have some type of cap on it. But we'll help producers figure out what that difference is and make a payment based on that amount.
Cost share assistance will also be made available to cover eligible costs in treating hay or feed to prevent spread of invasive pests like fire ants. Another eligibility requirement, producers must have incurred feed transportation costs after January 1st of this year. Applications for payment under this provision of ELAP must be submitted to local FSA offices by no later than January 30th, 2022. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
We are drinking more and more coffee and consuming more and more caffeine. This trend has both positive and negative aspects. Gary Crawford explores both on this edition of Agriculture USA.
And now, here's a 1946 movie scene that's set in a coffee shop. Roll that film.
I want a cup of coffee.
Okay.
Just a cup of coffee.
That will be 20 cents, please.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Stop the projector. 20 cents for two cups of coffee? It's no wonder U.S. coffee consumption reached its peak in 1946, with the average American consuming that year almost 46.5 gallons of coffee. But after that, coffee consumption began to turn downward, and 60 years later, 2006, the average American was only drinking about 24 gallons of coffee. But now, coffee's coming back. So perk yourself up while we brew up this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford. Everybody likes a great comeback story, and coffee's certainly one of those stories, going from 60 years of declining popularity to today, re-imaged, remarketed as a prime high-value product, retooled and made fashionable for today's lifestyle, and with every type, flavor, configuration that anybody could imagine. Oh, it is a new world of coffees out there. Comedian Tim Hawkins says the way that many women deal with coffee these days is different from men. He advises men who want to impress their wives or female friends to do one thing.
Like when you go to the drive-thru, learn what they like to drink. It'll blow her mind. It will, because women are, that's a hard drink. They're very complicated.
Yes, it is true. Yes, sometimes I go to the drive-thru coffee shop and my daughter will ask me to bring her not just a coffee, no.
A hot grande caramel macchiato with almond milk.
I have to write it down, and even then I'm not sure it's right. Also, for home brewing, that arena has totally changed too, being taken over by this single cup brewing machine, sales of which are soaring. So all of this is bringing coffee consumption up from a per person yearly average of 24 gallons in 2006 to over 35 gallons last year. And coffee is inspiring songwriters to write songs about it. Here's one from someone who feels he's gotta have his coffee.
Hook me up to the machine. My bedtime is coffee.
His blood type is coffee. That's unsavory, but some people do say that coffee's appeal is more than just taste. It also might be due to 1,3,7-trimethylxanthine, in other words, caffeine, which brings up the question,
do you really need all that caffeine?
But Kansas State University Extension food scientist Karen Blakesley says, like most things, there are pros and cons about coffee.
There are some potential benefits, such as getting some polyphenols and antioxidants that are naturally in coffee. They could possibly protect against some chronic illnesses like type 2 diabetes or heart disease or even some types of cancers.
But on the other hand, with coffee,
you got to be careful that you don't drink a whole lot of it because of the caffeine content. Too much caffeine can affect a whole range of other things, such as raising your blood pressure or making you jittery or increasing your heart rate.
The new government dietary guidelines for Americans says healthy adults can safely take in about 400 milligrams of caffeine a day. So that's about 4 normal size cups of coffee a day.
But do you have a heart condition where caffeine could increase your heart rate, and that might not be a good thing for you?
Also, she says, consider that coffee may not be your sole source of caffeine. There's tea. 8 ounces of tea can have as little as 20 milligrams up to 120. And then you've got soft drinks. 20-ounce soda can have from 22 to 70 milligrams of caffeine. And then, of course, a relatively new arrival on the scene, energy drinks. They can range from an 8-ounce can with 80 milligrams to a little 2-ounce drink with 230 milligrams of caffeine in it. Plus, we have currently on the market caffeine-enhanced waters and other things. So Karen Blakesley says if you are curious about your actual caffeine intake,
the International Food Information Council has what they call a caffeine calculator. It's on their website at foodinsight.org.
It's got places to type in there how much and what type of coffee you drink each day.
Even decaf coffee, instant coffee, different types of tea, sodas, energy drinks, and chocolate.
Again, that website is foodinsight.org. It has all things caffeine. One more thing. Karen Blakesley says if you've got to have a lot of caffeine to simply stay awake,
maybe you need more sleep.
Could be. Maybe you took a little snooze during this edition of Agriculture USA, huh? Well, this is Wide Awake. Come on, wake up. Wide Awake. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's our news for today. We will be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Welcome back. The National Black Growers Council held its annual field day virtually on Friday. NBGC Chairman Philip Haney gave some opening thoughts, followed by the NBCG Executive Director, Hazel Reed.
I'm a fifth-generation farmer from Virginia, and I have the pleasure of serving as chairman of the Board of Directors for the National Black Growers Council. On behalf of the Board of Directors, we would like to welcome you to our September field day virtually here from Limestone County, Alabama. We're very grateful to the Bridgefort family for their hospitality and their generosity in being such gracious hosts. We're very thankful we have sustaining members that support us so that we can offer this to you. We're thankful for our supporting members, you behind the cameras right now, who are able to tune in to watch and witness a part of what the National Black Growers Council is trying to offer. We realize that there is no culture without agriculture. The National Black Growers Council is here to do our part to sustain diversity in production agriculture. And we're thankful we have support to help us carry out our mission, which is to improve the efficiency, productivity, and sustainability of black row crop farmers. So with that being said, I'd like to thank you again for tuning in. Thank you again to our sustaining members for all of your support. And we hope that you learn a little bit more today about what the National Black Growers Council has to offer. Thank you.
You know, we had set aside somewhere in the neighborhood of roughly 30 minutes. And of course, that was done based on the fact that I normally interact with these guys from time to time. I serve as the executive director. And oh my, when they're talking with me, they keep things rolling. I mean, you wouldn't believe it. So I said, well, why limit them to 5 minutes or so? And you guys have really surprised me this morning because I really wasn't expecting to have any time left given the conversations that we normally have. So this is fantastic. We're moving along, nicely. I'm a former dean of School of Agriculture at one of the 1890 land grant institutions. And in my office, I used to have a sign there. And it was an anonymous quote. I really don't know who coined it. And so I'm not going to take credit for it. But the sign read, regardless of man's artistic pretension, his sophistication, his very existence depends on a 6-inch layer of topsoil and the fact that it rains. And so some people would argue, they'd say, Hazel, that's an oversimplification of the enterprise. But I want you to think about that. I want you to think about that for a minute. Yes, man has achieved miracles in terms of technological advances, not only in terms of equipment, but also medicine, plant genetics, you name it. And we have done it or we're working on it. And it's fantastic. It's fantastic. But I would also argue that the agricultural enterprise is key to man's survival, because with the technology that we've developed in engineering and mechanics and genetics and plant breeding, you still have to manage that 6-inch layer of topsoil. And today, as we proceed with this virtual Fields Day, you will get some indication of how that's being done. And that's why agriculture is so important, and it's so important that all racial, ethnic and minority groups are involved in the production enterprise. I would like to take a moment and thank our sustaining partners, but especially John Deere. They have really stepped forward and supported NBGC in ensuring that this Fields Day, this virtual Fields Day, is a success. And so you're going to hear from Mr. Denver Cardwell a little later, but I wanted to take this opportunity to express my appreciation to him and his leadership team for his outstanding support and the cooperation that he's provided to the National Black Growers Council. Are there any questions or comments that anyone would like to make at this point? Hearing none, we would love to move forward with our safety and health agenda. If you look at the document that you received by email, it lists Ms. Crystal Morris, AgriSafe. And so she and her team at this point will be providing us information on safely operating harvest equipment, the COVID-19 updates, and also stress management and mental health. But prior to that presentation, I'm going to take a point of privilege as the presider. And I'm going to emphasize COVID-19 and its variants. Too many of us are overlooking that. Those of us who are on the religious side of the house, we express appreciation to God and we ask for miracles. And then when we get a miracle, such as the vaccine for COVID-19 and its variants, we have people who refuse to take it, and they politicize it. And it's not a political issue. It's about the health and well-being of this nation. So we have a commitment not only to ourselves, but also to our neighbors and our friends. And I hope that my bosses don't run me off, for taking this strong position on COVID-19, because we're not a political organization. But this is extremely, extremely important for public health. One of the reasons that we had to go virtual today is because of the concerns that the Bridgeforths had with respect to persons being vaccinated, and this is the most important time for him, in fact, all of agriculture here in Alabama, because this is the harvest season. And so he has to protect his workers, he wants to remain safe, and he wants you to remain safe. So, all of you out across the country, please, let's don't worry about the politics of this. Let's worry about our health and protecting the health of this country. That way, we can get back to our normal routines.
Farm Service Agency Administrator Zach Ducheneau was one of the guests during the field day and talked about changes at USDA.
When we go around the country, the USDA is still sporting a black eye from the treatment of socially disadvantaged producers, and it's the FSA's fault. We're aware of that, and we're going to change that. And we're working to push the boundaries of our flexibility in all of our disaster programs. We're taking a look at flexibilities in our loan programs right now to see what we can do better that makes more sense to the producers, because we're aware that it all starts on a foundation of finance. And if our producers get put in a place where they don't have as favorable terms as the non-SDA producer across the fence, they're set back. Thank you all to be able to do that.
Other topics at the conference included cover crops, safety and health, crop genetics, and more. You can find out more on the National Black Growers Council website, nationalblackgrowerscouncil.com. If there's a topic you'd like to know more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.